For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's
right. Coming to you live from the Mount Woodgie Studios, The Clink. Stories of redemption here on the Gold Coast. Today, we have an amazing guest, Mahmoud Fazul. He is a man that's actually walked both sides of the line in reference to gangs, motorcycle clubs, and also the story of redemption. Mahmoud, welcome to The Clink.
Thank you for having me, brother. Really appreciate it.
Mate, for people that don't know you, I initially heard who you were and I did my homework and I realised what a cool character you are. And to be honest with you, someone who I really am looking forward to chatting to. We both shared some very interesting paths and since our chat, I think realised that we have a lot more in common than we knew. For people that don't know you, let's introduce you from your point of view, mate. Who were you?
Well, who am I? Still trying to work that one out, brother. I think grew up around Dandenong area, you know, in southeast suburbs of Melbourne, mixing with some would say the wrong crowds, but, you know, mainly just my cousins and that.
Are you Lebanese?
I'm Afghan.
Afghan. Okay, sorry. Yep.
Yeah, so my parents came, the first generation of Afghans in the 80s.
Yes.
So it was kind of the first wave of Afghans. So we were all born and raised here, like a lot of the Lebanese communities in Sydney. So I grew up in the southeast. You know, parents did what they could, you know, went to you know, small local public schools and that, and got involved in a lot of drama. This my first year of high school was 2002, so it was the year after 9/11. So, you know, Afghanistan was really in the spotlight.
And
yeah, it was all over the news.
Just to touch base, you are a Muslim as well.
Yeah.
So living that at that stage.
We grew up like Aussie kids, you know what I mean? We didn't even know much about Afghanistan. We spoke the language at home and stuff, but we were way more Aussie than we were Afghans. But at after 9/11, it threw all of us into under the spotlight, where, you know, certain people stop fucking with you because of who you're told you are. Like, yeah, we were told we were suddenly Afghans and Muslims, and these labels that were kind of abstract to us because it was shit our parents spoke about started meaning something. So we had to actually, yeah, we had to do all sorts of funny shit, like learn where in Afghanistan we were from, like in the libraries and that. Like, we didn't fucking know. But then suddenly you start creating this identity around that, and it becomes something that's not real because you're playing a fantasy of what you think your culture is and what you represent and what the news is telling you you are, you know, and what these guys, you know, some blokes telling you, calling you terrorist and that. And then suddenly you start getting angry about it, eh? And then...
Yes.
So we got in a lot of blues and that, and it was
when you say we, was it a group of men that sort of came together to basically, I guess, support each other through that time and look out for each other?
No. But the funny thing was, even the Christian Arabs were getting loot, like put in our box as well. So they were waxing with us too. So they did it hard too.
Yeah, right.
You know, in that time period. But so, yeah, then we, you know, we get in the fights and that, and carrying knives to school and that, and, you know, lockers full of machetes and stuff. And it was a time when phones started getting videos. And so, you know, we had a chip on our shoulder. So we were fucking around more than we should have. And, you know, smashing people and putting the videos online. It was like the start of all that stupid shit. And yeah, so I got in a lot of trouble there. Yeah, my dad had enough, and he took me out and took me to a school that was completely away from the area. like away from all my boys and that, like completely threw me into corporate.
Like a Victorian country school?
It was like closer to the city and that.
Oh, so. Really?
Yeah, so he put me in Caulfield, which was a really good school, and it was a spin out because, you know, my old school, everyone, no matter race, religion, or creed, like everyone was just fucking up. Like everyone just wanted to jump the fence at lunchtime and have a ciggy and just kick back, you know. Yeah. But at this school, like everyone was like wanted to read and like, well, like you're a bit of a dickhead if you didn't want to study, you know. So it was okay. A completely different mindset, and so I started getting into that.
As in the well. Study, you started to actually educate yourself. Okay, so you enjoyed it?
In my last 2 years. Yes, in my last 2 years in high school, I started to really, really put my head down, and I got into I got into the Victorian College of the Arts, which is a really prestigious art school in Melbourne. And they only accept like 20 kids from the state, wow. You know, so I got selected for that. And
so you're not silly. Then, you're quite an intelligent man, obviously.
Nah, come on,
bro.
That's yet to come.
Listen.
We'll
choose certain paths. So you're going to a school where you're educated and you're enjoying your studies, and I guess life's not so bad for Mahmood at this school. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was good. But just rewinding back a bit, like when I was fucking around at school, I was also making a bit of money in that, you know, like I had older relatives, people in my community that were, you know, giving me money and giving me gear and that to do runs on a push bike.
So you were doing drugs, like selling drugs, basically. Is that right?
Yeah, when I was like 14, 15, you know, like very young, like dropping off, dropping off smack and all that, you know.
Yep.
It was very normal in our area. It was just that time, you know what I mean? I went to uni, I did pretty well, but then, you know, what do you do with a fine art degree? Not much, you know what I mean? Like when you're studying art, you know, to try and have a career in art, it's a very difficult thing. So it was like a fine art degree that centered around film, like it was mainly a film course, like.
Okay.
So I did that, and I did pretty well. Like, won a bunch of awards, got out, couldn't get a job anywhere. Like, applied everywhere for every job under the sun, just couldn't get nothing. You know, a few years passed. Went back to the area, started hanging out with the same boys. You know, my family, because all of my friends were either in the city or in the area. And yep. So when I was out of the city, back home. I was back in the area with my boys, so I just started waxing with them.
How old?
This is 21.
So life's really just starting to kick off for you. Some big choices obviously have to be made from here on in.
Yeah, so it was like, can't get a job, fucking no one's hiring. Waxing back with the boys who never worked anyway, coming out of high school, and they're making money, and then you just start doing what you're doing, like start doing what they're doing to make a buck, and then that was a period where, you know, the ice was really kicking off, you know, it seemed in my area everyone was on it back then, like we're talking 2010,
yes,
you know. Around that area, 2011, it seemed like everyone was on it. People like lawyers, accountants, just like everyone that you saw the boys selling to, like it was a party drug.
Ice is the perfect destructive drug. It's easy to make, highly addictive, and it's everywhere. Destroying families, causing carnage on our roads, and murder in our homes.
I didn't even know, mate. I don't even think I knew anyone that was on the rack back then. Like it was all everyone was on the eye in that.
Wow.
But then got looped into that, started hitting, you know, doing what you had to do to pay for that and start pushing that and pushing heavy and started making moves.
Were you indulging in that at that time?
I was hitting
that
hard.
You were. So you ended up having what I guess would be a habit from that, an addiction, would you say?
Yeah, for sure.
So naturally,
you know, it starts on a Friday, then it's Friday, Saturday, then it just keeps growing and getting a hold of you. And so you just, And then we started making a bit of noise in our area. A lot of people kind of respected us in our areas, and we were doing all the wrong things and impressing the wrong people or the right people in our eyes at that time, you know. Yeah. We felt like we, for the first time, we were getting respect and belonging. Yes. And stuff like that, and validation, you know.
Yep,
people absolutely. People started to give us validation, and that encouraged us. And so I was introduced in a roundabout way to a club to represent represents the boys on the inside and that. And that's how I got involved in the club life.
With the club scene, and if you're happy, we'll get into a little bit. Like myself, you're a senior member, had been in around the scene for a long time. What was your first impressions? Putting all that effort in at school and stuff, did you feel some sort of sense of rejection after coming out, maybe because of who you were and that time of the way the world is? Did you feel at all that that could have been...
You always play mind games with yourself like that. Like, you're always trying to blame everyone but yourself, you know what I mean? Yeah. You want to blame everything. So I was just... There were other things I could have done, obviously, you know, to fix my situation, but I chose the easy way out, man.
You went back to what you know best.
A bit of push gear. Do you know what I mean? In my area, that's the sad reality of it. Yeah. In my area, it's easy to make money that way. Why it's easy to make money that way? Why our area is trapped in systems like that and cycles like that? I don't know. I don't have those answers. But all I know is when I was growing up in certain areas, a lot of the boys, that's how they were making money.
Isn't it funny? We talk about areas. I'm a product of the Housing Commission area, low demographic area of Western Sydney originally. And I got to be honest with you, it was you weren't accepted if you weren't doing something that wasn't normal. Abnormal. You know, like if you went, I know I had, you know, there were blokes out there that had older brothers and that, and a couple of those brothers, you know, would be mechanics or whatever, and they were going to work every day. But they'd still come back to the hood, and then all of a sudden they're still, you know, whether they like it or not, they get mixed into it. And whether it's after work or weekends or whatever it is, you're never 100% detached from that environment. And they say that we become products of our own environment.
And you got to remember, at that time, we're talking now, 2012, around that, man, the bikies were like the epitome of being, you know, outcasts, outlaws, you know what I mean? Like being the poster boys of whatever it meant to give a big fuck you to society, you know, in many ways.
I think everything changed around that era too, because, you know, as you would know, the golden rule was, you know, we never put ourselves on show publicly unless, you know, it was needed to be done, but everything was generally in-house. I mean...
And I shouldn't have to say this, but before I get into it, like, we need to understand that whatever I say about a club or the club or anyone I was affiliated with, if you know anything about that world, you know that if you're away for 3 months, let alone 4 or 5 years, that's a totally different club. Like, whatever I say is not representative of what any outlaw club's like, not even the one that I was in. No. Like, I don't represent that. It doesn't have it. And what I'm talking about is a club at a specific moment in time.
Yes.
for that moment in time. Most of the blokes, I don't even know, you know, if they're still there. So, but if we're talking about, if we're talking about that club at that specific time when I was there, man, to be honest, it was mad. It was great.
They were good times, weren't they? I said in my story, I fucking loved it. I loved my brothers. I loved the club.
I wouldn't be there every two or three times a week, man. Like, I loved all the boys there and everything. But when we first went there, it was just like, man, you see blokes at the gate, big fucking lights, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everyone in their colours, the bikes are out, you know, there's girls there.
There is a wow factor, isn't there? And you can understand why it attracts young men.
There's a wow factor, but when you walk in a room full of men who've got the same intentions, you know, there's an energy that intention creates. And you can feel this aura of whether it's respect or, you know, it's like you're in a room full of people that are willing to die for a way of life.
Yep.
You know, that's a pretty fucking full-on thing to experience, which I don't think you can experience in any other part of contemporary society, really. Like where you know, it's not like a football club. Do you know what I mean? Like,
look, I think
it's not that kind of camaraderie. You know, it probably only exists in the military or something. Well, you know, where people are dead set on something. Well, and we're talking about a period where, you know, as you would know very well, the Vlad laws got introduced and clubs were going through really, really hard, conditions, and it was all over the news that the politicians were really going after them and targeting them and making them an example. For their tough on crime, you know, political agendas.
Motorcycle gangs saw the introduction of controversial laws. They've since faced heavy criticism, even from a former Gold Coast detective.
It was a Friday night. A busy Gold Coast restaurant became a bikey battleground. Dubbed the Broadbeach Brawl, it was the fight that started a war.
It was a time where if you wanted to be involved in that, like, it was really separating the boys from the men. Like, there were some serious sacrifices being made. Of, like, you know, I think there's the sentences in Queensland where that if you were in a club, you got an extra 10 years on your whack or something like that. You know what I mean?
I think Queensland was the one of the toughest ones. Queensland and New South Wales came down extremely hard, in different variations of the law.
We're talking about a time where I've sat in a room as a very young member and heard stories about older blokes trying to fight this thing in the high court, putting their houses up for this lifestyle.
That's right.
You know, selling their bikes. You know, these are guys that don't do that sort of shit. They were selling their bikes, man. So putting their houses up.
Well, what about all the businesses? All the businesses. I mean, like, you know, anybody that had an affiliation or a criminal history all of a sudden couldn't do their tool of trade, whether it be tattooing or, you know, anything similar that had relevance to, you know, I guess cash money and you know, the public as such. I know blokes that were going onto building sites and, you know, these, especially in Brisbane, and they're getting asked, oh, look, mate, are you affiliated? You know, have you had any, we can't have you on here. And I'm like, what the fuck? I'm coming to work, mate. These are just blokes that ride bikes that have enjoyed the club life. Look, you know, not everybody, and I think this is something that people hear but don't realise, not everybody in the club has criminality. You know, not everybody has intentions to go out and do this and that and move this. And, mate, there's so many good men that just love the camaraderie, the brotherhood, and riding bikes.
I would say most of them.
Bro, how good's a fucking national run? How good's a national run? Especially when you're sitting up the front of the pack somewhere and you're looking back, man, and you're just seeing all these brothers behind you and, you know, you're side by side. There's no better feel. And I'm sure you don't regret that period of your life either.
Of course not. I loved it. And the thing was, the things that drew me away from it, and this is when I started getting involved in, that was, like, I know people think I might be, you know, just trying to save, I'm not trying to save no one, but I was involved in shit myself that a lot of people were telling me, don't get involved in that, like, trying to help me, like, when I was on the eye and that, like, the club got me off that.
See, that's a pretty powerful thing, because you and I both know that's one of, well, predominantly these days, I suppose, I don't know, like I said, but I know that we went through that period that, you know, heroin and ice were forbidden. You know,
it was fully forbidden. If you got caught with a pipe, gone, pumped,
you lost everything. And suck over your dick, because it just, what it did was, at that time, is it just destroyed. It destroyed chapters, it destroys families, it destroys brotherhood. You were blessed, obviously, to have a staunch team of brothers around you that believed in you, obviously.
Bro, but not just me. I've seen it happen to other blokes too. Like, they really went out of their way to help a lot of blokes, you know what I mean? And that's no word of a lie. People that were in that world or in that club at that time know, like, they you know, they really went out of their way to help blokes get their shit together, gave them many, many chances.
See, I give credit to the men that you were around, because I think that, you know, that's no different to doing what you or I do today, trying to help others not to walk down that path. I mean, it's not about belittling the club. It's just our better choice for us, obviously, personally, and the life that we would like to now live and be better for our kids.
Yeah, exactly. Like a lot of people give us a lot of their time, a lot of their wisdom. You know, there's a lot of wisdom in those clubs, especially when you go on to Adelaide, you know, some of the clubhouse there, it's drenched in history, true outlaw history dates back to the 70s, and you got blokes that, you know, you and I might know, and they were very intelligent men and very well spoken, and they were giving you wisdom that this kind of like this old mythical like ancient wisdom that had been handed down to them right by their elders. You know what I mean? And like,
it, you know what I loved? You know, I always loved. They were the blokes that would never talk to you, and you used to think, "What the fuck's wrong with these blokes? What am I doing wrong?" You know, like. I walk in and I respectfully, you know, greet everyone when I come into the chapter and, you know, organise everyone's drinks, whatever. We've all had to do it, mate. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, you get the grump and the groan, and it's like, fuck off, mate. Why? What's your problem? Next thing, you're accepted. And that brother will be the first brother to come over and give you the biggest hug, pull you in, and like you say, start to share some knowledge and wisdom.
I had some moments I'll never forget, man, when I got my colours.
Was it old school way of getting your colours?
I don't know what that means.
Ah, well, there's either one or two ways. You get a bit of a touch-up or they get handed to you.
Oh, no, I didn't get a touch-up. No, it was all love. But we're talking like some of the blokes like you described, not they weren't grumpy, but you're talking, these were some of the most... if you ask a reporter, quote unquote, the most terrifying men in the country, and you know they shed tears when they finally
give
you your colours. Do you know what I mean? Like this is like, you know, moments like that you cherish for the rest of your life. But going back on the political thing and this kind of vilification of the outlaw clubs at that time, we need to put that into perspective. And the perspective is in Queensland, which dished out those laws the hardest. Less than 1% of the crime that was happening in Queensland was by outlaw motorcycle club members.
Correct.
You know, this was purely a symbolic attack on a community that you know had the looks of being the bad guys and the villains of society, and so they were targeted. I'm not saying anything about clubs now, but I'm saying at that time.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
That those were the statistics, but yet it made a good narrative. It was a good political sell. If you want to appear tough on crime, you go after the people that, you know, or the subculture that looks the best, that represents villain, you know, that villain attitude in the most, you know, kind of Hollywood way, which was outlaw motorcycle clubs at the time.
A particular international club comes across, this particular club that you're with went into a massive big court battle, you know, to better their situation and prove their point, which made it very difficult for a lot of club members to live in Queensland. Is that right?
Yeah, man, that's what the news and the media reports on these issues as though they were fleeing the state because they were, you know, on the run or something, but they weren't.
No.
It's because you literally couldn't, the laws were so harsh, you couldn't live in that state.
That's right.
You couldn't actually live. You couldn't live and work and earn a living for your family and pay your mortgage in that state. Like it wasn't an option. And then you had blokes that had lived here for 20 years getting deported on bad character grounds, no charges, nothing, just because they were... members of Outlaw Motorcycle Club. They had kids here.
See, I don't even like that word bikey. Bikey to me is like, what? We were always fucking more than a bikey. You know what I mean? We were brothers in a club. It was an outfit. And it was a very well-organized outfit too. Bikey's a bit of a dirty word to me. You know what I mean? I never see myself as a bikey. But I feel that there was a lot of men that contributed in a positive way that, they were in clubs. But what they gave. They paid their taxes. They provided an honest family home. They, you know, looked after their families and anybody else. And I can guarantee you could probably leave your kids with them, your bank balance, and your missus. She ain't going to get raped. Kids aren't going to get touched. And you're not going to get fucking robbed for every dollar you got.
We need to make this point clear, too, that we're not talking about the 501 deportees. We're not talking about people who've committed a crime. And because they've committed a crime that's cost them, you know, a sentence that's of over 3 years or something. We're talking about people who were ordinary citizens. They were just members of an outlaw motorcycle club. And then...
which become a criminal offence, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was purely that they could... if you had dual citizenship, they could revoke your Australian citizenship on bad character grounds. And a criteria of that bad character ground was affiliation with an outlaw motorcycle club. So we're talking like a bloke could have lived here for 25 years, paid his taxes, run a mechanic shop, had kids here, but because he had dual citizenship and he was associated with an outlaw motorcycle club, they cancelled it overnight. Yeah, right. And you have to go home. They had their citizenship cancelled because... of bad
character.
Like, that's the kind of madness that was going on. But no one was like, you know, it's a hard line to sell because people don't want to sympathize with the bad guy or whatever. Like, it's just an amazing thing to try and wrap your head around.
But, so you Mahmood, become a part of the next step, the next generation, I suppose, of moving forward with that club.
Well, I just trust I trusted the elders, you know, who obviously had more experience than us, and so we backed them as they had backed us, and we just, you know, we went 110% of the way with them, you know, but then you know, as like I said, I started getting involved in petty things on the side, you know, like getting involved in area disputes, you know, internal area disputes personally. And then
is that more drug area disputes, or is that when you say area disputes?
Yeah, kind of like that. But even just crew disputes, you know, you go out, one of your boys gets in a scuffle with one of their boys, and then it's like it turns into this big drama, and then it's like, because you're part of someone, you have to act a certain way.
Absolutely.
And even though your boy's in the wrong, because then they're gonna take word back to their area and say,
"Well,
oh,
it's a weakness, isn't it?
We put it on their club. We put it on their club or something like that. Like that. Do you know what I mean?
That's and what so, I mean. It looks like a weakness. You didn't retaliate. You didn't do anything. And then you know, we got your men.
Yeah. A lot of drama's happened.
It's full on, isn't it? And it does. It escalates from there. And history tells us that.
The last 2 years. I lost, you know, at one point I had more of my close mates in prison than outside. I lost my cousin at the age of 21. He got 15 years or something like that. I went to about 4 or 5 funerals in the space of 2 years, you know, in 2 years, man. You know, that I don't know soldiers that have gone to Afghanistan and lost that many mates.
This is the cold hard reality, and I think the purpose of us talking about this too, we're not here to glorify any of this lifestyle, or you know, what Mahmood and I are doing is speaking directly about our own personal experience, with all due respect to the clubs that we're referring to. And as you've probably realised, we haven't, you know, sat here and disclosed any names, and nor do we need to. We both are very well documented with where we've been and who we've been with. So I guess it's more in a way of bringing awareness to the next generation that think that, you know, it's all good to get up there and get into it and all this sort of stuff, but you got to be prepared to put your body and your life on the line at times, eh?
Well, for me, it was like you're burying some of your close mates, you know, and very brutal. They died in very brutal ways. And so it damaged me hard. You know, I was diagnosed with bipolar, and I had, you know, major depressive episode, and I didn't come back from that for a long time. You know, I was on the Prozac pretty hard, just using anything as an escape, started self-medicating, just wanted to wreck myself, you know.
Did you go back to using the ice?
Nah, I didn't. But
so that was final at that then, stage. You got off.
Nah, I was dead. That was dead to me. Yep. After I joined. Yeah, they killed that out of me. So I think I still had a bad taste of the paranoia about being caught with that. Yeah, I just wanted to. The thing with that is, it makes you too alert. I wanted to be dead to the world, man. You know what I mean? Like I wanted to just fucking wreck myself. Yeah, I had some really dark moments, man. I had some incredibly grim thoughts run through my head at several moments. You know, I did some fucking. There was some, like, you know, I hit rock bottom, man.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, straight out. And it takes a man to admit it, you know. Like, I've seen, you know, the weakest version of myself. I've experienced it, you know. I've been able to confront it, you know, and make some serious decisions, like, but the thing that saved me really was, like, you know, I went to these funerals with my best mates and I saw the way their mum, you know, looked into the casket, you know, and shit like that doesn't leave your fucking mind.
No.
And then trying to think, like, do I want my mum to, you know, be looking over my casket in that way, you know.
It's a cold reality, isn't it? That's exactly what your dear mum would be doing.
Yeah, and your brothers, like, yep. You know, that's the way that it, you know, and then you suddenly, you know, you have to, even doing shit like organizing your best mate's funeral, like, you know what I mean? That sort of shit fucks with you. And then thinking, who's going to do that? If I do this to myself, who's going to, you know, but what do I achieve out of doing this? You know, that you don't achieve nothing doing that, you know, taking that way out. So I thought, you know, in, I've seen what happens to people and what can I do now that I'm alive? Do you know what I mean? How can I, as a living person, you know, contribute something,
was this,
leave something behind?
Was this sort of the stage where Mum Wood has sort of said, you're going to move away from club life?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, that was like, yeah, that happened when I was pretty damaged, you know, but.
Yeah.
And then so I went back to studying and stuff.
You did you? Studied. After club life, you went back to studying?
Yeah, I studied psychology.
Wow, you are a Vesely. Yeah. I told you in the start. You're a very smart man. You're a clever man, brother.
Yeah, well, I actually wanted to do, like, counselling and that and, like, actually help. I wanted to counsel people that had experienced trauma, you know, because PTSD was something I had a lived experience with. I wanted to help people get through that, especially people that might have been involved in, you know, in our life in some way, or people trying to reintegrate into society and things like that. So, but then a friend of mine introduced me to someone at Vice. And I proposed a documentary about some young Muslims in the area who were on the cusp of being radicalized. So I proposed a documentary about them. I started filming interviews, but then they all got raided and put in jail for over a series of terror raids. And so that didn't get up. So I wrote an article for Vice about that. And then Vice just offered me a column. They said, we're really interested in your angle and your perspective on things. If you just write for us every week. And I just thought, man, that's a job, you know. I didn't want to get involved in any other way of making money at that time.
If you Google your name, I mean, that's the first thing that comes up, is all your contributions to Vice.
Yeah, so Vice was where I basically learned about how to write journalism, but did it in a way that I knew would attract, you know, young people from my demographic, because the only media that they read was on Vice. Like, they
what is Vice? For those that don't know, Mahmood, could you just explain what sort of media Vice is? And
yeah, well, Vice was known for, like, pretty punchy, risque content, tackling news and politics and global issues in cutthroat ways, you know, whether it meant our boss, the boss of the company, going to, you know, parts of Africa and interviewing warlords and cannibals, you know, or reporters going and embedding with ISIS when ISIS first basically established a caliphate. You know, our reporters were the first to go there and actually see Raqqa and all, you know, some of these cities under an Islamic State, like pretty out there, risque type of takes on contemporary issues. And we're telling stories that, you know, people, you know, sometimes people aren't telling. I mean, of course, like the New York Times is sending people into the depths of fucking hell when it comes to ISIS and sending them to the front lines. But I think the way Vice does it is pretty interesting, because they're young, usually young reporters, not traditional journalists, trying to understand the human side of the story, you know, trying to show the everyday people in these stories. Like, I've got a documentary with them coming out in a month or in a... I went to Tokyo and hung out with the Yakuza, and basically, I spent a bunch of time with members, former members, a former Don, an active, you know, Don.
Are you covered in tattoos?
Yeah.
So taking your shirt off, you, like myself, have sleeves or noticeable tattoos? Yeah. Because everyone I've spoken to that goes through Japan that's lived a little bit of a life like us, they're pretty onto it. They pick you off, especially if you're
well, that's why
through.
They were cool with me. Yeah, that's why those guys were cool with me. When the camera crew got there, they were a bit hesitant. And
I actually remember a story about one of your old brothers, and I know him, and I both know him very well. He's a very well-respected man, and he went there with another one of your brothers, and they had a little bit of, I don't know if it was conflict, but there was a lot of questions asked from the time that they come out of the airport. A rather large, big young man from Queensland.
Well, that happened to me, man. When I came back, I was swarmed by customs officers, and actually the terror officers it was in Brisbane or Gold Coast. I came via there, but as soon as I got off. It was like, as soon as I got off the plane, didn't even have a chance to get my luggage. They just pulled me and my partner off the flight and went through all our shit and asked us what we were doing in Japan and Tokyo. And these
did they believe you when like, you're over
I'm
there
a
telling
reporter
you?
Now.
That's what I was about to say. When you're over there doing a legitimate documentary about the Yakuza, is it pronounced Yakuza or Yakuza?
It's Yakuza. But I was interested in them because, like, they're finding it really hard to recruit new members.
Well, their government's shut them down, haven't they? Like, they are completely, like, shunned upon. Isn't it even in public?
You can't even open a bank account, for example. You can't get a mortgage on a house. You can't do anything. Like, you can't have an address like they do.
Is that if they have proven that, though? Do they have to prove that you are an affiliate or a member? Or, yeah.
Yeah. But to become a member, you know, you have to basically do their version of prospecting for 3 years and live in the office, because they've got offices, not clubhouses.
Yeah, I've heard about the offices in the big buildings.
Yeah. So they so you have to live in the office if you're a prospect.
How the fuck do you live in one of those places?
Yeah, wow. You do, and you're just at the beck and call of their members. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. I don't know. Yeah, I feel like outlaw clubs aren't having much trouble recruiting, whereas then it's interesting that the Yakuza does, and they claim it's because their internal rules are too hard for young people to follow.
Their own affiliation, their own outfit.
Their own code. Yeah. The code of conduct of being a Yakuza member is so strict. I think that's from speaking to some of the members, that's what they believe. You know, young guys aren't really prepared to do big whacks, or they're just not, they'd rather just join street gangs and start making money straight away. Whereas in a Yakuza family, you're literally trying to become a member of the family. And by the time you're a member and actually earning, for 5 or 10 years have passed, really, before you start, you know, rising in the ranks and stuff like that. It's very, very old school. But we are talking about a tradition that's hundreds of years old. Like, the Yakuza goes back, you know, it's part of Japanese culture, it's part of their society.
Well, there you have it, Mahmoud Fazil. I'm sure you'll agree with me. He really does have a great story to tell. We've only just started. Next week, part two of his story, he talks to the Yakuza.
That hotel room will be rigged with cameras and all sorts of shit. They'll go there, get fucked up, you know, have sex, and then they'll basically extort them, you know, send them the photos of them in compromising situations with these young girls.
That's next Monday on The Clink, Real Life Stories of Redemption.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, for the record, yeah. For the record, yeah. For the record, yeah. For the record, for the record.
Want to thank a new sponsor who's just come on board, Dr. Pickles Tattoo Aftercare and Lifestyle Products. They're made in Brisbane and are known right around the world. They have this amazing balm. It's called the Original Tattoo Balm. You seal and protect your tattoo with the OG. I've just been using it on my leg after I had it done, and I tell you now, my skin feels amazing and there's a great shine to it. They also have an antiseptic spray you can spray on and wipe over your tattoo to keep it nice and clean so you don't get any infections. They've got a 3-in-1 wash. It's all natural, smells great, packed full of peppermint, citrus, and wait for it, hemp oils. How good's that? Plus, they have a SPF 50 sunscreen, which acts as a moisturizer as well as protecting your tattoos from fading and stop them from getting sun damage. Right now, though, for the Clink listeners, they're offering 15% off with the code CLINK. Just head to drpickles.com. That's drpickles.com.